The Helly Kasser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HellyKasserJane.com.
That's how'd this rock and roll all get started, anyway?
Well, what they call rock and roll now is rhythm and blues. I've been playing for 15 years in New Orleans.
This rock and roll music seems to be under an awful heavy attack from all over the country. There's been riots, it's been banned in certain parts of this country and abroad. You know of any reason for that?
Well, as far as I know, music makes people happy. I know it'd make me happy.
You wouldn't blame it on rock and roll?
No, indeed.
He tickled the ivories like no other. Took us to Blueberry Hill. And is the subject of an important documentary premiering Friday, February 26, 10 p.m. on your local PBS stations. That's Domino, The Birth of Rock and Roll, as part of the 30th anniversary season of 13's American Masters series. The director of the film, Joe Lauro, joins me at my table today, here on the Helly Kasser Jane Show, along with the woman who has been called New Orleans Ambassador for Music, Idae Ellis, one of Mr. Domino's closest friends and also an associate producer of the film. Hi, and welcome. I am your host, Helly Kasser Jane. But before we begin, the Helly Kasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HellyKasserJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helly Kasser Jane Show is always available online at HellyKasserJane.com and a host of venues including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and on the iHeart Radio Network. Considered by many to be the father of rock and roll, Fats Domino was one of the most popular rockers of the 1950s and early 60s. His achievements and record sales during that time were rivaled only by Elvis Presley. With his boogie-woogie piano playing rooted in blues, rhythm and blues, and jazz, he became one of the inventors, along with Presley, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Little Richard, of a revolutionary genre of music, rock and roll. With hits such as Ain't That a Shame, Blueberry Hill, Walking to New Orleans, and more, Fats Domino's brand of New Orleans rhythm and blues appealed to black and white audiences alike. Friday, February 26, 10 p.m., American Masters celebrates Fats Domino on his 88th birthday in its new documentary, Fats Domino, The Birth of Rock and Roll, directed by one of my guests today, Joe Lauro, and featuring a longtime friend of Fats Domino and associate producer of the film, Idae Ellis. We begin with Joe Lauro. Let's talk. Joe Lauro, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. How are you?
I'm terrific. Thank you. So good to have you here. And just what a terrific thing you put together, really. The birth of rock and roll. Time and history are very funny things. I never thought among the public at large that Fats Domino ever got the due as the father of rock and roll that I think he is, and I think you do too. Yeah, and you do a really great job of helping us understand the pivotal role that he played in the popularization of the big beat style and the birth of rock and roll in your documentary. Airing, by the way, let's get this in right up front, Friday, February 20th. 26, 10 p.m., but also the important influence he had on the music of the 60s and 70s. But, Joe, I want to tell you something that I think you might find interesting. Ready?
Yeah.
I did the last interview with the late, great Joe Franklin. How weird is that?
My mentor.
Right. And when I just found that out, and then I said, oh my gosh, so I want to talk to you about your interest in collecting vintage shellac records. This, I didn't know this about you. This fascinated me. Victrola records, 78 RPM records. I have some here you would probably love that were my dad's. You've been doing it for 40 years. Talk to me.
Well, I started collecting when I was about, I guess when I was about 12 or 13. Joe Franklin has something to do with it. He would come out on Channel 11, New York, and I'd be home from school sick or something like that, and it seemed like his show was on for like 6 hours in the afternoon. It was endless, and I mean, I was just home, you know, Mom let me watch TV with some soup, and I turned on his show, and he was talking, and I remember he showed a clip of Eddie Cantor from a short film that I've since found that Joe had in his collection, and I was just completely mesmerized. And then I think the same week, maybe the same day, at 2 a.m, I couldn't sleep. I was watching TV in my room, and the jazz singer came on. So I got this double dose of American vaudeville with Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor in one day. And I don't know, it did something to me. And while I grew up loving rock and roll and playing, electric music and all that, I always had this secret world of vaudeville. And, then I kind of changed it into jazz as I discovered stuff in blues and gospel. But all that kind of pre-World War II music that I started collecting, I just would get on my bicycle and, with my newspaper route money, and I knew that these guys made records way long ago. I had no one to tell me where to find them, what to do. So I just kind of like started haunting the antique shops, and eventually I started finding stuff. And records were, if it was more than 50 cents, you didn't buy it, So, you were lucky if it was a dime.
Right.
And I was a dime kid, and I bought a lot of records for a dime. And I didn't know what I was buying, but I started listening to them, and that's how I figured out what I liked,
And so music has become the fabric of your life. Okay, so you've directed a host of documentaries, including two on the great Louis Prima. Oh my gosh, one of my passions. I love him and Keeley Smith. But let's bring in our second guest, because I think the story goes, and she and I talked off air, so I'm not sure quite what the story is and how she got and you got together and how this whole thing came to pass in this fabulous documentary. So, Aide, are you there?
I'm here.
This is Aide LaFay Ellis. She's a character. You guys are going to love this lady. Okay, so talk to me about this. Music has been a part of your life, as well has been New Orleans, Fat Domino's home. That's where you hail from, too. Talk to me about how you guys got together, you and Fat.
Fat and I, how we got together. Well, I was working with a young man by the name of Jerry Embry on a radio show called the Creole Gumbo Show that showcased all types of Louisiana music. And it was on public radio, a weekly program, hour program. And the first half hour would showcase one particular artist, and this included playing, a lot of the person's music, and it usually included an interview. And the second half, we just played all Louisiana music, brass and R&B, Cajun, rock and roll. So Jerry had a rare thing. He had already interviewed Fats when Fats was recording at Ultrasonic Studios, when he was recording his Christmas album. He had allowed Jerry to interview him, and that was hard to do at that time. So we did that, and we did the program, and Fats asked Jerry to bring a tape of the program to me. He wanted to hear it. So Jerry asked me if I wanted to go with him to Fats' house, and of course I said yes. And I brought him a big pink cake, a strawberry cake. It was pink. It was on a silver paper platter with camellias, pink and red and white camellias all around it, and strawberries all over the top. And we've been friends ever since. That was almost 25 years ago.
It's a long time. You're part of the music industry. You played, right? You had a group, a band. So yes. Music has been a passion of yours. So it would seem right that you could relate to Mr. Domino. Talk to me about this. He's 88 years old on February 26th when the show was going to air. 88.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
But I want to start with his childhood, Joe. You talk to me. Give us a little background on him for those who don't know.
What I know about it, his family was from the sugarcane plantation, I guess, sort of slightly northwest Louisiana, little town called Vacherie. And the Domino family lived there for generations, and they worked in the fields. They were, you know, they were part of that whole thing. I mean, his grandmother was a slave, so he comes from that background. And at a certain point in the 1920s, his father got an opportunity to come to New York, and they settled in the Lower Ninth Ward, and that's where Fats grew up. He was the only child of a large family of children that actually grew up in New Orleans. And I wouldn't call them poor people, but they were regular folks. They lived in the neighborhood. The neighborhood had a lot to offer. There were lots of other people, although at the time it was very rural, I'm told. So, you know, there were no street lamps, and, you know, they were delivering ice. You know, no one had electricity, no telephones, maybe one phone at the store down the block like that. So he had this sort of humble beginning. And at a very early age, because of living in New Orleans and having all the great musical influences, many of which lived in the Lower Ninth Ward, he got to hear some great piano playing and some great music, and it struck a chord with him, and he wanted to emulate that, like we all do when we're young musicians. We hear something that just kind of sets us, and we want to do it. And that's how Fats started playing.
And Fats did that. I mean, it's extraordinary. When I was watching this documentary of yours, and you were watching him, just watching this guy play the piano, that's a trip. He doesn't even have to open his mouth. Do you know what I'm saying? There is it's just wow. It's just totally, totally wow. But you can't tell his story and not talk about New Orleans. And listen to me. Talk to me about New Orleans and music. I want to know what it is. Is it something in the water? Is it something in the seasoning? I mean, music is just central to everything that is that town. Talk to me.
Oh, yes. I think, I can't remember whether it's Alan Toussaint or Ellis Marsalis who said that it bubbles up out of the sidewalk and out of the street. And was it Cato or Ernie Cato who said he thinks all music began in New Orleans? I don't know what it is, but I tell you what, there was a lot of music in New Orleans that came and still does come out of the Lower Ninth Ward. There were several families of musicians who lived down there. The Lasties, I think maybe the Marsalises, I'm not sure. But it's just everywhere. It seems like everybody plays music.
Everybody plays music. And before we go further, I want to say this about Joe, about this documentary, and I want to ask you about it. You know, a lot of these documentaries, they get these big, well-known people, you know, who kind of fill in, and, you know, you don't know whether you're going to promote them or whatever. You didn't do that with this. You went right to the core, to the people who really could understand Fats, the music, the history. Mm-hmm. How come?
Well, I feel that when I want to tell these stories, I get to choose how I want to do it. And I made a bunch of decisions on this film, and that was one of them. Because, you know, to get celebrities, why are you doing it? Because the reality is they really don't have any more to say than I do or anyone else that was influenced by someone like Fats. But people are interested because they're, quote, celebrities. Well, that's not good enough. I mean, you want to really tell the story. You talk to his family. You talk to the people that worked with him for 50, 60 years. You talk to his friends. And my opinion, or your opinion, if you were influenced by Fats, is just as valid as a famous person. And I'd rather spend the little bit of time that you have to tell somebody's life story, you know, talking to the people that really significantly were there. And that's how I make films, because I'm thinking about these films, not to be so bold, but it's true. I don't know that there'll be another film made about Fats Domino. And I'd like mine to be the one that when people want to learn about what this man was and what his music was, they go to it. And the presence of a celebrity, be it a Bonnie Raitt or a Keith Richards or a Paul McCartney, whatever, as wonderful as those people are, it's not going to mean much, you know, in history when someone wants to learn about Fats Domino. But Billy Diamond, who's he? Well, he was Fats's road manager and his first band leader and his friend. And that's a much more significant contribution to me.
And I think that is probably what drew me so into this documentary of yours, because I felt, number one, I felt like I was there. You took me there.
Oh,
that
nice.
That doesn't always happen, you know? Sometimes you're the viewer and you're looking at the history book. You took us there in this, and that's why I highly recommend everybody really watch this on Friday night at 10 p.m. It's true. But I want to say this to you as well. Let's talk about, you brought him up, let's talk Billy Diamond, but first let's do this. Fats was born Antoine Domino Jr., right? And Billy gave him the nickname Fats. I don't think a lot of people know how he got that name. Can you tell us?
The story that Billy told me was that, you know, I mean, obviously Fats, even then, or Antoine as they all called him, he liked to eat. He was a chubby fellow. Is chubby a word you could use these days? I don't know. When I used to shop for clothes, my mother used to take me to the Husky department. I hated it. But, hey, you know, yeah. We had a little bit of weight. Fats did, too. And there was a singer by the name of Fats Waller, who was also a piano player. And Billy just started calling him Fats. He said, I'm going to call you Fats for Fats Waller. Fats didn't like it so much, but that was the name that stuck. And then, of course, he did The Fat Man, which was his first record that sold a million copies. And, you know, Ade is the person who introduced me and led me to a lot of the people that are in the film.
Ade, you've led some wonderful life, I have to say. You've surrounded yourself with some pretty extraordinary people and really got into the heart of that music industry in New Orleans. I'm P. Green with envy. Do you hear me, darling? I would love to have played in the same field that you played in.
I recognize the fact that I'm lucky. I am lucky.
I have a feeling it has a lot to do with this wonderful personality of yours that we're all getting to understand now.
Ade is like an ambassador of New Orleans music.
I love it.
And I could not have made this film without her assistance.
Well, there you go. That's a pretty nice thing for somebody to say on air. Ade, I want to ask you a question about something, because we watched this film, and this film deals mostly with his music talent and the rise and all that. Talk to me about the man. Tell me about the man. Who is this man? What's emanating from his heart? What do you feel from him when you're in his presence, when he's just you and he?
Well, Fats, you know, Fats is just a very, very regular person. He's just a very humble and shy man. And he's a man who he loves his family and he loves his friends. And I think he's happiest when he's at home in New Orleans. Naturally, everybody knows he never has wanted to leave the neighborhood that he grew up in, and he never did leave until he had to leave because of Katrina.
Right.
And he's happiest when he's either in that house or when he's on the stage playing. And I think when he's on the stage, he just, you know, that's just the top of his happiness right there. It's just sort of the icing on the cake.
Is it a different
person? He loves it. It's terrifying, you know, but he does it.
You're saying he's terrified of performing?
Well, he gets very, very, even after all these years, these so many years, he gets very worried about it. Yes, he does.
Wow, that's interesting.
But once he gets up there, I'll never forget one time he was playing at the House of Blues, and he hadn't played in a few years. And I had brought him some flowers. And his brother-in-law brought me, he said, Ade, come here and let's bring back the flowers. And so we went to the room where he was getting ready, gave him the flowers, and I could see his brow was all furrowed and he was worried. And so I didn't stay long. I just handed him the flowers and said, Fats, you're going to have a wonderful show, and left. And I went back to where my husband was sitting. We were sitting with some members of the family and some friends. And I said to Ronald, Fats' nephew, I said, Ronald, Fats looks so worried and upset. And Ronald said to me, he said, Ade, the minute he puts his hands on that piano, he's going to be fine. And sure enough, it happened.
Wow. Isn't that interesting?
I was at that show, Ade. It was probably around the time we were working on Louis Prima. He was playing at the House of Blues in New Orleans. And that's one of the reasons why I said, oh, my gosh. I mean, he was so, the band was just so amazing. You closed your eyes and it sounded like the records that he made in the 50s, because he made it so perfect. You know what I'm saying? This was one of the great things about Fats. You know, when you see some of the other older fellows like, you know, Little Richard and Chuck Berry and all that, they often have bands that they pick up along the way that are not really rehearsed. You know, Fats' band was guys that had been in it for 50, 60 years. The arrangements were played just like the original arrangements, and it was an amazing experience, and especially at the House of Blues, where it was only 1,000 people. That's one of the reasons why I said, man, I'd love to make a film about this guy. It's too good.
Believe it.
He was dressed all in white that night, right, Joe?
Yeah.
Was that the night? Yeah,
I believe so.
And, you know, he always said that he wanted his music in a live concert. He wanted the music to be exactly like it is on the record. He didn't want to change it at all. And I would think about that a lot. And I thought that the reason for that was because Fats loved his fans so much. He always said that if you told him how talented he was, how good he was, you'd say that God gave him that gift. And if you told him how popular he was, he'd say, well, that's thanks to my fans. But I think he felt that the people were fans of his because they heard a certain thing on his record or in a concert. And I think he felt like that was sort of a contract with them, that he owed it to them to keep it the same way that it was when they first heard it.
So let me throw this out there. Yeah, you know, I've been around the music industry a lot, if you guys know a little bit about my background. Here's my question. There are a lot of people who aren't really nice. You know, they're just not, you know, and they're great performers and they're really interesting to watch on stage. But boy, they're really, really not nice. Get the feeling that that's not true, Fats. I get the feeling this guy is as genuine and real and wonderful as a person can be. True. Yes. No.
He definitely is. I have never seen him refuse to have a picture taken with someone or have something autographed. He never, ever refused that. I don't care where he was or what he was doing. He always honored those requests. He's just very sweet.
Joe, you talked to an awful lot of people during this film who have been around him and around the music industry in New Orleans. Question, can you separate the man from his music, or is his music just so core to who he is that he is the man and his music, as Sinatra might sing?
Well, you know, I would say that his delivery of the music is the man. What he puts into it personally, the little smile, a little wink to the camera, and a soft voice, a soft, sweet voice with a hint of a Creole accent, and the piano playing that he learned early on that he never really departed from as a great boogie piano player, which he creatively, you know, put into the music that he played later. I mean, in that way, you can't separate him. He is the charm of those songs. When you listen to Smiley Lewis do Blue Monday and you listen to Fats Domino, it's two very different things. The original version that Dave Bartholomew wrote was recorded by Smiley Lewis, and Fats' approach to the same tune and practically the same arrangement is just so Fats. It's just so charming and melodic and sweet, you know, and you can't separate them that way. And I think one of the difficult decisions I had to make in this film, making this film, was how much do I really want to talk about the man? And I chose to really, out of respect, I chose to talk more about his music and have him do the talking about his life rather than talk about all the war stories that every darn musician that was ever on the road has the same stories when it comes down to it. You know, basically the same thing. You know, everyone wants to hear that stuff, and everyone says, well, you know, what's the soul of Fats Domino? I didn't go there. I felt that the music was enough. He comes through the music so much, and I didn't want to talk about private things. Everyone has turmoil and tragedy in their lives. I left that alone because a man that sold 60 million records by 1962, well, that's a story into itself. And I know that people have criticized my decision that way, but I stick with it. I think that, you know, while if I had another 3 hours, I perhaps would have gone in there more, but I focused on the man's career because his personality comes through in the music enough where you could figure it out.
I don't think you have to apologize that. One of the notes that I made in preparing just for the interview was to say to you that you left it to the music and, interestingly, I think the camera to portray the soul. Now, I'm just a nosy broad, which is why I'm asking all of the questions that I'm asking, because I want to know. But I think you got there. I mean, one of the notes that I made was, if you look at his face, wow, his face just is a gorgeous portrait of everything that must have happened to him, good, bad, and indifferent in that. And so is the way he belts the song. It's his heart, which is why, yeah, I'm so fascinated by him. So I, you don't have to apologize for that. Like I said, it's just me, the nosy broad who wants to know all the ins and outs, and I'm going to continue going.
The last line of the film, it's not in the PBS version, because that version is about 35 minutes shorter than my cut, which is on the DVD. You know, he says, I just want to get right with the Lord. This is the most important thing to me now. You know, is to, you know, be a good good person in the eyes of Jesus. You know, I mean, if that doesn't tell you what this man is all about, then nothing does.
Right. And yet, look what happened. Look what he did. The father of rock and roll, right, that had parents all over the world going wacko about their children being exposed to what? Right? For no reason, really, if you think about it. I'm always interested in how many Southerners were important into the development of rock. Good, you know, religious, you know, raised on faith people. And yet rock got such a crazy, crazy name. So that's a point that I think needs to be made. Joe, I want to talk to you, and Ida, you can bring this up, talking maybe about this too, and that is this big beat, this thing that did become, that is so New Orleans, that is so different than music that comes out of any place else. Can you guys talk about that a little bit in terms of Fats and how he developed his sound?
Well, I could start on that, and I'm sure Ade will have a lot to say about it as well. But Fats's music really is rhythm and blues. You know, which rhythm and blues is music that really started springing up right after World War II, and it was just that, rhythm and blues. It was a lot of bluesy chords. There's strong elements of jazz. A lot of it was played with large band, you know, like not huge swing bands, but, you know, bands that were, say, you know, 10 pieces or less, like people like Louis Jordan. It was jump music, you know, and Fats was just playing New Orleans version of rhythm and blues, and he didn't change it a heck of a lot. It's just kind of like rock and roll kind of came up around him, and he fit into that category because it was rock and music. It was swinging music, and that swing comes out of New Orleans, and it comes out of swing musicians that were playing early rock and roll. You know, you listen to, like, modern rock and roll drummers, and they kind of attack their drums. Well, you know, a swing drummer makes the music lift rather than make it kind of, like, strong and beatless. I mean, you know, a swing drummer will elevate the music and make you want to dance, you know, and that's where Fats's music comes from. And then the New Orleans thing, well, Ade could talk about New Orleans music.
Yeah, talk about that. And let me throw out names, because I think some people may not. Jelly Roll Morton, Dr. John Smokey Robinson, Winston Marsalis, Harry Connick Jr., Louis Armstrong, Mahalia Jackson, the great Al Hurt, the late great Al Hurt. The list is so long, it's ridiculous. And there is a certain thing that you can put with all of those people that you would recognize New Orleans sound. What is that sound? Where does that come from? What's that about, Ade?
Me? Are you talking?
Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking after you asked me about New Orleans and the, you know, the history, I should have mentioned most of those people that you just mentioned, Buddy Bolden and Jelly Roll. I mean, you know, Fats certainly heard all those things, you know, some of those things anyway, when he was growing up. And then when he did learn to play, and he was taught how to play by his brother-in-law. No, wait, his brother-in-law.
Harrison
Barrett, who played with an old New Orleans band called Papa Celestine's band. And Harrison taught Fats how to play. And Fats, they had an old piano, an old upright in their house, and he played until the keys were, you know, worn away. And then when he got out and he listened to people like Albert Ammons and Pete Johnson, Louis Jordan, he loved all of that. He would tell you about that. He showed me videos of these people so I would understand, you know, where he was coming from. And then when he was really young, I think he played some with a little bit. You know, we would just sit in as a guest with Paul Gayton, and they're all kind of stories about Fats, you know,
early on. Yeah, wouldn't you love to be in his head and hear what the sound is? I mean, you know, it comes out in his music, but I wonder if it ever stops. I wonder if he's always hearing music. I wonder if it's always that beat, boom, 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 boom. It's fascinating to me, guys like him, but that's my crazy. I want to talk about some of those people who you bring up, who have been a part of his life, his music life, I should say. You talk about Diamond, and there's this whole thing with the record company. And you want to talk about that a little bit? Luchud, Imperial Records, Dave Bartholomew. How could you have this conversation and not talk about any of those people? Talk to me, Joe.
Well, Dave Bartholomew is one of the great, great New Orleans musicians, trumpet players. He's in that dynasty of great New Orleans trumpeters that really, you know, includes, you know, Buddy Bolden, who's not, you know, and of course Louis Armstrong and King Oliver and all the great trumpet players that came out of that city. And he, in fact, he studied from the same man who taught Louis Armstrong, you know, Peter Davis from the Waits, the Colored Waits Home. That's where Dave got his early lessons, the same guy that taught Louis Armstrong. So, you know, Dave is part of that dynasty. The man is still living. And he was a force to be reckoned with in New Orleans starting in the 40s after the war. He led probably one of the most popular, if not the most popular, rhythm and blues band. And that was the new music at the time. So it was a little different from traditional New Orleans jazz, like Papa Stell, Celestin, and all those guys. That was trad music, traditional music. Dave was on the cutting edge, man. He was like the newest rapper on the block today. Dave was cutting edge, and he knew what he wanted. He was assertive. He was talented. And Lou Chudd hired Dave Bartholomew to basically be the A&R man, the talent scout for his brand new label, Imperial, that was going into rhythm and blues because that was the music that was selling at the time, certainly in the African American market. So Dave was poised in New Orleans, recording at the one studio that they had, Mr. Cosmo Matassa's studio, and they were looking for talent. And Dave said, "You got to hear this guy, Fats Domino. He's shaking him up, you know, at the Hideaway Club." And he brought Lou Chudd down there, and Lou signed him immediately. And like within a week, they made their first record. It was Dave and Fats and Herb Hardesty, who's still living, in fact, who played in Fats's band from 1949. Until the last performance, basically 60 years later. And you know, and those guys are now part of that dynasty of great New Orleans music. And it always changes in New Orleans. People are not sitting back and just playing old stuff. It's you know, music is about pushing things forward. And you know, certainly Dave did that, and that's what Fats was part of as well, just like Jelly Roll Morton was. Jelly Roll Morton recorded some of the first sort of orchestrated jazz. He got traditional New Orleans music, and he scored it out rather than just playing it sort of free like it had been played. And he has that credit, you know. And some of the beats on those records, the second line beats that Jelly Roll Morton incorporated into, you know, his great sides with the Red Hot Peppers, well, those beats are on Fats Domino's records too. And Fats incorporated those into pop music. And nobody knew. You know, kids that were listening to Fats Domino records in Iowa or New York or anywhere, they didn't realize that that was traditional New Orleans. They just knew it swung and it made them want to dance, you know, and that's the beauty of New Orleans. That's what makes that music different. You know, you can listen to Chuck Berry, you could listen to Little Richard. I don't hear, and even Elvis, I don't really hear so much regional sound as I do when I listen to Fats Domino. Fats Domino's records are pure New Orleans.
Fascinating.
Well, Joe, as you know, Fats over and over has said, "All I did was take rhythm and blues and play it faster."
That's all. If he did anything, that was it, yeah.
Well, it worked, didn't it? It worked.
He didn't change it.
It worked for him. It's funny, though. You are listening to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. My guest today, the director of the new Fats Domino film, Fats Domino, The Birth of Rock and Roll, airing on PBS American Masters, Friday, February 26th, 10 p.m. Eastern, and Ida Ellis, longtime friend of Mr. Domino's. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Hi, this is Hallie Kesser Jane. Are you enjoying the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKesserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. You think about all of that. That first hit that he had, The Fat Man, which came out of a song called The Chunker Man, right?
Because Chunker's Blues.
Yeah, Chunker's Blues.
Champion Jack Dupree was a New Orleans barrel house piano player, blues singer.
And then the rest, as I say, is history. But let's talk the term rock and roll. There's a great piece in there about Alan Freed. Do you want to talk about that? I love that.
Well, Alan Freed allegedly coined the term rock and roll. Alan Freed was a DJ, and he did a lot of live shows, and he brought some of the R&B people. And, you know, I'm not a historian, so, you know, there's people probably listening to your show that know far more about this than I do. But what I know is that Alan Freed coined the term, although the term rock and roll had been used for 20 years prior to that. I have evidence of that. But nonetheless, Alan Freed certainly popularized that term, and it became indicative of the new music that was, you know, being bought by teenagers at the time, which was a little hard-edged, you know, and a little bit more, you know, like Ade said, a little faster than regular R&B. And you know, and that's where that whole thing started. And, of course, Fats was part of that. Fats played in a lot of the early Alan Freed shows. He headlined them, in fact.
Right. Well, let's bring up the issue of race. Certainly is pertinent to his story. Certainly is pertinent to the story of rock and roll. When he does finally make it, and that wonderful song, Ain't That a Shame, right? First person who covers it is the whitest of white, and I know because he was my next door neighbor, is Pat Boone. This is true. Is Pat Boone. What in the world? I mean, and then that becomes his first crossover hit. Now, that just is astonishing, because if we think of Pat Boone now and Pat Boone then, two different people entirely, but and at the same, not so so different. But this issue of blacks and whites and music and the separation. But really, when you think about it, it was music that in many ways brought them together, and certainly Fats is part of that. Talk about that, Ade.
All I know, I'm not sure, wait, I'm not really clear about what the question is, but I guess that Fats always said that he never even thought about the problem with the races. He said, all I was thinking about was my music. However, I do know that he was known to refuse to play unless the line was not drawn between, you know, there was often a line in between the white and the blacks in the audience. You had to
usually a rope.
A rope, right. And he on some occasions refused to play unless that was taken away. But Fats was not at all combative on the subject. He you know, he was pretty mild on the subject. As far as he said, I don't know how he really felt, but he said, I really didn't worry about that too much. I just was really interested in playing my music.
Yeah, but you can't ignore it because it was certainly there. I mean, talk about he goes on the road, obviously, and racial tensions, and then other things started to happen during his concerts, if you will. Youthful delinquency, beer bottles, and dancing skirmishes led to at least four major riots at his shows. I love it. I mean, that was part of rock and roll. That was happening everywhere with a whole lot of different people. That wasn't necessarily color-oriented. But he also had to suffer the hardship of segregation because I think it was made that the 100 miles they would have to go out of their way just to find a place to sleep.
Oh, yeah. That was very hard on them. Yes, he'll tell you that. That was hard. But I think he just really never felt like he was being, you know, treated. All he thought about was his music, he said. He said that repeatedly. So I can't believe that it was really that easy. Maybe he just didn't want to say it.
Right. I mean, I can imagine.
But it's a sad story, too. I remember talking to Fats, and I asked him, well, you know, the Big Beat, I'm sorry, not the Big Beat, The Girl Can't Help It was a huge film. It was Technicolor, 20th Century Fox. And I said, Fats, did you go to the premiere? He goes, well, I saw it in New Orleans. And he said he saw it at the Sanger Theater on Canal Street. And he said that he had to go upstairs. He wasn't allowed in the orchestra. Now, here's this one of the stars of the film. I said, well, how'd you feel about that? And he said, well, he just kind of accepted it. It wasn't a big deal. It was the way it was. He wasn't there to buck the system, but he was able to work within it pretty effectively.
That was his attitude. That's what I meant, Joe. You said it better than I did. Yeah, he would always say he just went along with it, you know.
Well, what was your choice? If you wanted to play, I guess you had to go along with it because that was the only way you're going to get to play.
What are you going to do? Billy Diamond was the master. Billy Diamond knew the, quote, Chitlin' circuit like the back of his hand, and he would go out there. He'd find all the rooms for these guys. guys. Fats is playing in Cleveland. They might have had to drive to Dayton to find a place to stay. But Billy knew that whole circuit. He knew all the people. He was a charming man. He was a bit of a hustler, too. And he lined all that stuff up. He knew the roads to take, the places where they could eat, and the rooms. They were not even hotels sometimes. It was just people's houses that they'd had to stay. Now, here he is headlining a show with, 3,000 people sold out, and he can't stay in the town.
Bizarre.
And that wasn't that long ago.
That's so funny that you said that was the word that was going to be. 1957, that was around the corner.
Yeah, into 1960,
right.
I mean, wasn't that long ago, boy.
I mean,
we have come a long way, and nothing is ever perfect, and it won't be for a while, but think about that.
Well, I do. And what brought to mind was the Super Bowl and, Beyonce still feeling that she had to make some noise about all of this and Black Lives Matter. I mean, we've come a long way, baby, but we haven't come a long way, baby. But music does seem to bridge a huge gap between the differences. And that was something he can be proud of because I think he was part of that. Blueberry Hill. Let's talk about Blueberry Hill. I mean, because in the midst of all of this craziness that was going on in those days, here he comes with just one of another hit, another pop standard. That one ranked 82 in Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. That's pretty cool to be able to say that. Talk to me about how he felt about that song. Do either of you?
I could talk a bit about it. I know this. Fats wrote his own tunes. He wrote stuff with Dave. They contributed to each other. But the record company, Lou Chud and his people, had a lot to do with some of the other material that they, had Fats record. And Blueberry Hill was one of them. Lou Chud was there to try to sell records. So, to him, to get Fats to really sell some records is you got to make some sort of white-sounding records. And he gave Fats a lot of, sort of tin pan alley standards to try to, turn into the Fats Domino sound to see as an experiment how they did. And they were done with different degrees of success, but clearly Blueberry Hill, which had been around for, 20 years before Fats got a hold of it, Fats made a huge hit out of it. It just worked with his style, and it was a wonderful melodic song.
It's a perfect song for him, actually. One of the things that I really did love, the most incredible moments of this film of yours is just watching Fats sing. Just there he is. And, you don't get to get that visual, to a new generation. It's ear. We don't see him. It's startling to watch him perform. So he does the crossover thing, and he starts to get on the big shows that are the hot shows of the day, Perry Como, who else, Steve Allen. There's great footage. Something that going back to this issue of black and white, I was thinking when I was watching the piece on Perry Como with Joe Stafford, that in New York and L.A. that would be okay, maybe. But can you imagine into rural America when they saw Fats Domino standing between, how crazy that must have made a lot of people. And I think a lot of the yelling at rock and roll was really saying, what's the deal with this, with the black thing. I still maintain that. But there's a heck of a story about his appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show that just tore my heart out. You want to tell that story, Joe?
Oh, you mean the story? Well,
at the end.
About Papoose. Papoose Nelson was Fats Domino's guitar player during his greatest years in the 50s, early 60s. And, Papoose, who was also part of the New Orleans dynasty, Papoose taught Dr. John how to play the guitar. Dr. John idolizes to this day. That's his man. And he was this gentle man. And there's some other sort of deep New Orleans law that I think Ade knows about with who shot the Lala. That was Papoose's brother and all this great stuff. A lot of the families, the musical families are connected and there's more than one person. But anyway, he was a junkie and they were in town. They were right before they were going to Europe. They stopped in New York and they were doing the Ed Sullivan Show. Now that's the Ed Sullivan Show. That was the number one show. Okay. It was enough to have a black rock and roller on that show. There weren't that many. So Fats is doing this. They're going to rehearsal, and Billy Diamond goes over to the Teresa Hotel up in Harlem because Papoose didn't show up. It was late, and they find his body. He had had an overdose. And now they're supposed to be on the Sullivan Show, and he's the black rock and roll artist. They're guitar player just died of a heroin overdose. 1962 is a different world. So what Billy told me is that he paid off the guy from Ebony Jet and a couple other places. So they said that they didn't mention that he died of a heroin overdose. They mentioned that he just had died of a heart attack or something like that, because that would have been the end. He would, you know, that would have been,
right.
I'm not going to say the end of his career, but certainly if that got out, he wasn't going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show.
And also on that show, at the end, they made him stand up so that he would show that he was a sweet, fat guy. Wasn't that part of that?
That was the earlier. That was in 56.
Yeah, that's a crazy.
About 4 or 5 years earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. That was hard to understand. It's just way hard to understand. Haiti, he has, I'm going to get this name right if it kills me. Hiday, forgive me, please.
Believe me.
Okay, Holly.
No, I get that all my life, so I know how it feels, and I just kind of go, you know, it's like, what can I say? But Dr., he has a family. He has a wife. He has, what, 6 kids?
Eight. 6 living now as we speak. His wife died, and 2 of his children died.
Talk to me about family and him. Can you?
About family?
Yeah.
And fact?
Yeah. Music first, family first, what?
Oh, I would say they run neck and neck.
That's fair.
You know, Fats. Oh, sure. I mean, you know, Fats was born to play music, and I think that it was often trying for Rosemary, because it was, you know, that when you play like that, you know, all those people in the house rehearsing, et cetera. But it was fun. I mean, it was a lot of fun. I think that the children always enjoyed whatever he did, but I'd say his family came first, and then his music, but they were certainly mighty closely intertwined, let me say.
It's also hard to have a family life when you're on the road 365 days of the year. I mean, that's not easy either.
Easy.
No, I can't even imagine trying to keep a family and a marriage together under those circumstances. It takes a very special person to want to put up with that, right?
Yes. But luckily, Rosemary did it. She did it very well.
That's great to hear. He traveled the world. His career continued. The record company that made him kind of went under, and he goes with ABC Paramount. That didn't go well. And then rock and roll changed because we were invaded by those people from across the pond called the Brits. And even though the hits didn't keep on coming, he was revered. And I want to talk about that because I think that's really important, that even early on, the Beatles loved him. Everybody loved him. Like I said, he's a man whose career is getting recognition in our world, but in the musician's world, I think he was always recognized, right? Wouldn't you say, Joe?
Well, yeah. People like the Beatles and the people that are just like one generation younger, half a generation younger, you're always influenced by the stuff you're listening to when you're 12, 13, 14 years old. So when John Lennon was 15, Fats's records were just beginning to break. They made their way over to England, and they were cool. Little Richard, Elvis, that was the music that inspired, you know, the Beatles and the Stones and all those people to really want to do it themselves. The great American rock and roll and blues, rhythm and blues. So, and those records sold all over the world. And after Fats's, hits really started drying up, he continued to record, but, you know, he constantly toured. He was a huge star, really until the last performance he made. It never changed along those lines. You can always fill up a hall or a stadium.
Hiday, talk to me about Hurricane. Oh, you have more to say on that subject too, please. Talk to me about what you were going to say.
I was going to say that it was brought home to me not so long ago, just about, 3 or 4 years ago. I worked on the tribute album to Fats, and, you know, Robert Plant and so many musicians wanted to be. They were so pleased to be. They wanted to be on the album. Randy Newman said, when I said to him, you know, we're doing a tribute album to Fats, and we were hoping that you would like to participate. And he said, I would love to be on it. I've been stealing from Fats for years. And Yoko Ono wanted to give, I think John Lennon very early on recorded, there was a recording of him singing Ain't That a Shame that she gave us I don't think that it was ever out there any other way. But for instance, you know, there were just so many people who wanted to. Paul McCartney was on it. Alan Toussaint was on it. Nora Jones.
Yeah. It's lovely. It's absolutely lovely. I want to talk to you, Ide, about Hurricane Katrina. She's, you know, there's Hurricane Katrina to everybody. And then he really, talk about what happened to him, his whole life and his. And you're responsible, but you don't want to say you're responsible for bringing him back from Texas.
No, I wouldn't say I was responsible at all for bringing him back. No, indeed. Well, as you know, he was, you know, the water came up so fast and his family were all rescued from a second floor balcony. They were rescued by the harbor police the next morning. There were 14 of them, and they were taken. They eventually ended up in Texas, and they were there for weeks because, you know, as you know, the water did not go down. We called and called and called and tried to get him to leave, and he, you know, Rosemary and the family had lived through Hurricane Betsy. That they went upstairs, the water rose, but the water went right down again, so they were fine. And they thought, you know, well, this is going to be the same thing, this Hurricane Katrina. You know, we can, it might be a problem for a while, but it won't last. And so they didn't want to leave. And Fats did not, he said, Fats wanted to leave, but he said that his family didn't want to leave. And what kind of a man would he be? He said to me, what kind of a man would I be if I left my family? So they stayed. I mean, everybody was frantic. Everybody was trying to talk him into it. But they ended up in Texas, and they were there for weeks because the water in the lower Ninth Ward did not go away in a hurry. It was there for I don't know how many weeks, but they couldn't. Fats came back for a few weeks and stayed in. This was after about 6 or 7 weeks. He came and he stayed at a hotel that was in downtown New Orleans. And he was supposed to be looking for a house for the family to move back into. Now, one of his sons lived over on the West Bank outside of New Orleans, and that's where he ended up buying. But it took him a long time. The whole scenario really was very upsetting and confusing to him. And I think that he didn't really understand for a long time that he would not be able to go back to the lower Ninth Ward.
He lost everything. Yeah. He lost his Medal of Honor winners or whatever he got from, yeah, devastating.
Clinton.
Yeah.
It's a shame that all of his clothes, his rock and roll clothes, closets full of rock and roll clothes, shoes, wonderful things, all sorts of memorabilia were in that house.
Gosh.
And they were all gone.
I finally spoke to the
way that I helped him was that I encouraged him. I said, Fats, you have got to find a way for your family to come back here. And I think it's, you know, you really do need to buy a house. And so he did. And his daughters, I mean, his grown children managed on their own to get back some kind of a way. But his wife and his children who lived with them were still, you know, they needed a place to live. So he did that. He bought a house in Harvey, which is across the river from New Orleans.
Joe, he's been out of the public eye for a brief appearance, right? Is he a recluse? And how's he doing?
Well, back to Katrina, because this is sort of part of it.
Right.
I wouldn't call him a recluse. I mean, he's a man that it's like if you have a job, even if you like it, after 50 years, maybe you want to retire.
Okay, that's
good. And maybe you don't want to be around thousands of screaming people and getting in and out of the airplane and the bus. You know, he's a private man. And you know, let's go back to the Ninth Ward, right before Katrina, when I started to know Fats. You'd go over to his little house. Now, he lived in a double shotgun, which is a traditional sort of New Orleans house. It means that if you shot a shotgun through the front door, it would go out the back without hitting a wall. So you had to walk through Fats's bedroom to get to the living room. I mean, but next door was the super modern million-dollar 1960 modern house that Rosemary lived in. But he lived next door in the ultimate man cave, and he had all his friends. You'd go there anytime, and there's people hanging around. They're playing cards, cases of food are arriving. There's all this great hubbub of activity. People are knocking at the door. Well, when Katrina happened, all that ended. It's a different type of displacement. You could lose your rock and roll clothes and your piano, but a whole way of life ended for him and for many other people. Dave Bartholomew, too. It ended. They became old people without a focus anymore, because Fats was a little bit better off than a lot of the people that lived down there, and they never came back. Some of them died. Some of them never returned. The neighborhood didn't come back for a long time. And when you're, you know, pushing 80, that a lot of people don't survive something like that.
Absolutely.
Fats was never not what I'd call a recluse, just a man that was, as Ade said, a very basic sort of person that loved his family, loved where he lived, and loved his friends. And that's what he wanted. The other part of it was work. And work needed to end at a certain point for him.
Has he seen the documentary?
Have I seen the documentary?
No, has he seen the documentary?
Has he? I showed him the rough cut. I sent it to Adonica, his daughter, who Fats lives with, and she told me he watched it 3 or 4 times. And they had some corrections to make, which I of course did the best I could with those. It was a little late, but I was able to change the most significant ones.
That brings
so
tears.
And the great honor of my professional life was that he showed up with Dave to the premiere.
Yeah.
And that was an amazing moment for me. And I think it was a great moment for them too. You could only imagine when you have two people that work together and they're sitting there watching basically their career, their life, and, you know, things that happen early on. They're watching it on the screen. I mean, for me, the honor of having them there, but for them to see it and then, you know, complimenting me at the end, that was what made my day. I said, I don't care if anyone doesn't, you know, I don't care who likes or doesn't like the film. If you guys are happy, I've done my job.
Joe Franklin would be proud, I can tell you that. Go ahead, Ida.
And you know, that was the last time he was out in public in New Orleans, and that was October 2000. That was 2014.
Wow.
That was the last time Fats was out. And also, his entire family showed up.
Well, that's pretty terrific.
It's a great night.
Yes.
A great night. Ida, it's clear you adore this man. Adore him.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Why do I adore him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I just have so very much respect for him. I often think, how difficult was this for this man who at such an early age, really such an early age, who came from such a rural, basic background and was suddenly thrust into a world of fame and fortune. You know, I just think it must have been so difficult for him to do it with the amount of grace that he did.
Joe, some final thoughts from your point of view on Fats, the man and his contribution to music?
Well, like Elvis said, if it wasn't for Fats Domino, there wouldn't be rock and roll. And actually, that's what John Lennon said. There certainly wouldn't have been a Beatles, he said. And, you know, and the whole way things are done in New Orleans is different from anywhere else in the world. And I'm just so happy and proud that I was embraced by people that I have, you know, come to be friends with, like Ade, and that I was able to be put into this world, and that they trusted me enough to tell their story. And you know, his legacy will go on forever, and I hope that the film The Big Beat has just some little part, you know, some little bit that will make that, you know, survive even longer, where people could actually learn about it. So, you know, that's what I get off on with this stuff is, you know, just kind of getting it there so it's on the shelf, and when people want to know about it, it's there. Because, you know, I always say this, that in my opinion, the greatest thing that America has offered the world, one of them anyway, is its music. It's rock and roll, blues, jazz, country, gospel, all of it. It all comes from here. And it's work to keep it alive, for people to understand that heritage. You know, they play Mozart at Carnegie Hall. Well, they should be playing Louis Armstrong at Carnegie Hall in 100 years. And the only way that that will happen is you've got to create work that will allow people to be educated and understand it. And that's my goal, always has been. And I'm just so happy that I was able to do it on Fats Domino.
Fats Domino, Carnegie Hall, 100 years.
Why not?
Why not? Fats Domino quit school when he was 14 years old because all that he wanted to do was learn how to play the piano and be one of the best at it. He achieved his dream, and he made dreams possible for many others, men with names like Chuck Berry and Little Richard. He created a new kind of music and broke racial barriers along the way. And the world rewarded him for it all. By the end of his career, Domino was credited with more charted rock hits than any other classic rock artist except for Elvis Presley. He was one of the first inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Blueberry Hill entered the Grammy Hall of Fame. He received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, the Rhythm and Blues Foundation's Ray Charles Lifetime Achievement Award, and so many others. President Bill Clinton awarded him a National Medal of Arts. Rolling Stone listed him as one of the greatest artists of all time, ranking him at number 25, Friday, February 26th, 10 p.m. on your local PBS stations in celebration of Fats Domino's 88th birthday. Tune in to watch American Masters, Fats Domino, The Birth of Rock and Roll, as part of 13th 30th anniversary season and in celebration of Black History Month. For more information, visit www.pbs.org/WNET/American Masters/Fats Domino. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Helly Kesser Chain Show, a production of RESEC LLC. Visit HallieKesserChain.com.